We have Mr. Is it? I might mispronounce this. Let's see. Vorobyev.
Correct. Actually, that's correct, Your Honor. Vorobyev. Good afternoon. May it please the court.
Yeah, please proceed. And if you want to make rebuttal argument, please try to stop for your full 15 minutes.
I would like to reserve 2 minutes and I will try to watch the clock and stop it.
Okay, great, thanks. I'll try to remind you if you miss it.
Yes, sir. Good afternoon again, members of the court. My client's appeal raises four issues. Unless the court has a different preference, I wanted to talk about the jury instruction issue, the materiality jury instruction. We believe the instruction misstates the materiality standard by making it broader than the decisions of the Supreme Court and this court case, this court's decisions allow. The standard that is approved for materiality is that the decision, the statement has to be capable of influencing the decision-making body to which the decision is submitted. The instruction that was given over our objection was that the statement had to be capable of influencing the agency's decisions or activities. And it's the latter part of this, the ability to influence the agency's activities, that I have a specific problem with, because I believe that makes it a lot broader than what is allowed. Because once we decouple the materiality standard from the decision-making process, virtually anything you submit to the decision-maker has some tendency to impact their activities. You know, you submit a, you know, you make a statement, you know, they have to consider, they have to listen to you, right? They have to look at whatever information you provided. So that gets the trier of fact away from looking at whether it's material to the decision, to the ultimate decision, to the decision-making process. And
what about the issue of a wild goose chase? Because if you send an investigation on a wild goose chase, they're going to figure out after, you know, they waste a lot of time that it didn't go anywhere. So it won't affect the decision, but it certainly wastes a lot of time and would seem to be material in a common sense way. And it seemed that the district court sort of was focusing on that kind of a difference between what you were proposing and a simpler language.
Right. Well, I think it would be ultimately a question for the jury, and removing that language from the instruction sort of takes that away. It basically erases any distinction between whether it was something that truly sent the agency on a wild goose chase that on an issue that impacts the outcome, or whether it's just something, well, they had to spend some resources, but really didn't affect what they were doing in terms of the decision. And specifically, for example, I'm using this just for illustrative purposes. In this case, you know, the plane's altitude is a highly technical issue. And the testimony from the NTSB here was that if the GPS data is available on the plane, they would pull it down routinely. I mean, they look at it anyway. So a bare statement of altitude, or actually in this case, an estimate by a pilot that isn't necessarily accompanied for the purpose of this case, isn't accompanied by any kind of a technical data, any kind of reliance and any kind of a machine proof or physical evidence. So at least a jury could certainly find that it has no capability of impacting the decision-making process. You know,
if we're talking now not about the instruction, but about the evidence, there was a fair amount of evidence that he was flying low. We have witnesses who says he was flying low. We do have the registration that he was flying about 1,000 feet below what he testified to. It may not be a perfect altimeter, that is to say the more reliable altimeter lost its data as soon as the power was disconnected, But there's a lot of evidence that shows that he was flying about 1,000 feet below what he testified to when he spoke to the agency.
Well, I agree with you that that this is not a sufficiency of the evidence challenge. It's an instructional challenge. And I agree that there was evidence from which the jury could have found one way or the other materiality. I'm just saying that by making the instruction the way it was, it prevented them from making an opposite finding, because it made the materiality standard so broad as to make virtually anything to be material. That's my argument. I'm sorry if I was unclear about that. On the one hand, this was exactly the government's case. They were basically saying, look, it was material because they had, the NTSB had to check GPS to find out what altitude he was on. I know there was also testimony that they do that anyway, but the theory that was pushed through by the government in this case was that it's material so long as it impacts the way in which an investigation was conducted in a broad sense. And I think that steps away from the requirement that it has to impact the ultimate decision. And again, I'm not saying that the jury couldn't have found the other way of materiality. That's why I'm not arguing sufficient evidence. I'm saying that they could have found, there could have been a lack of a unanimous finding on materiality. There was enough evidence for that, but the instruction prevented that from happening. That is my argument. I don't know if I've answered your question there or not. Can you still hear me?
Yes, thank you. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. So that was basically my argument on materiality. And I think it made sort of switching over to the prejudice prong of the analysis. The burden is on the government. If the court were to agree with me on the error, the burden would be on the government to show that it's harmless beyond reasonable doubt. It's a missing element. And so long as there was enough evidence for a properly instructed jury to find or to decline to find materiality unanimously, I think reversal for a new trial would be required on both counts. And in this case, again, the error here, A, goes to, I think, the government theory of the case. B, it undercut one of the lines of the defense that was presented, because we did argue, at least one of the defenses, that, whether or not my client was accurately estimating the altitude of his plane, it was ultimately not material. And three, I guess I'm going to repeat myself. I think there was enough for a jury, if it was properly instructed, to find that the materiality hasn't been proven. Again, highly technical issue. One, which really would be governed by GPS evidence, and it's something that the NTSB would look at routinely when they look at the plane, if it's available, they will review it anyway. And, if you look at what happened in this case, again, I know that reliance is not a defense, lack of reliance is not a defense, but the actions of the agency are also some evidence on the materiality issue. I know it's kind of a fine line between whether it's lack of reliance or materiality, but I think it's an example of the agency demonstrating what it would normally do in these circumstances. They've perceived this plane crash to be a pilot error from the beginning. Especially if you look at count one, nothing that my client said about altitude altered, at least there's certain evidence that nothing that he said altered the course of that investigation, because they still deemed it to be pilot error. The only reason it escalated to a more intense investigation were the statements about the propeller and about the downdraft, the ones on which the jury declined to make a guilty finding, because there was a special verdict, there were a bunch of statements that were listed as possibly the basis for the verdict, and the only one that they found him guilty on were about the altitude.
And well, not necessarily. On the second count, not only was did the jury find as to altitude, but the jury also found that there was a substantial and rapid loss of altitude.
I apologize, and
that might well be caused by the propeller defect.
Actually, I would disagree with that. I think the rapid loss of altitude, they found that that statement is incorrect. But I think they made the declining finding about the propeller. I think it would be speculative to say that even though they've declined to make that finding, that they're somehow related anyway. So I, to be honest with you, the way I read the special verdict here is that they were strictly related to statements about altitude. In fact, I'm not even sure that anybody has ever argued them in tandem. I guess Mr. Corsi can correct me if it seems the record shows otherwise. But
he testified as to the propeller, that the propeller sheared off in flight.
Right. I mean, he made that testimony, but he wasn't convicted on the basis of that statement.
I understand that. But in terms of what he might have said that might have misled, if he said we had a rapid fall in altitude, well, what's going to cause a rapid fall in altitude?
The question is not only
how high he was, but the question is what caused it. And if you're looking around to figure out what caused the rapid fall in altitude, one of the things you're going to start looking for is whether the plane is under any power and whether the propeller is working.
Right. Your Honor, my understanding of the dispute about the propeller was whether it came off in flight or on the impact when the plane left.
That's correct. I understand that.
And again, I would say that I'm not aware of anybody arguing that there was that kind of a relationship. I hear what the court is saying, but that was, for, to be honest with you, was not the way I read the verdict or the record. I guess ultimately the court decides, but that was my reading of the record decision. So my point was that if the correct instruction had been given, they might have reasonably found that materiality has not been proven. You know, they also could have gone the other way. I don't disagree with that. And for that reason, I think the court should reverse both counts and remand for a new trial. Now, I see I have about 3 minutes left. I'd be happy to answer the court's questions if there are any. Otherwise, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Yeah, I have no questions. Judge Fletcher? Judge Collins? No. Your time is reserved.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll now hear from Mr. Corso with the government's position.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel Stephen Corso of the United States. This afternoon, we asked the court to affirm Mr. Kerr's convictions in both counts 1 and 2 for obstructing the NTSB investigation, as well as the appeal proceedings that stemmed from the August 24th, 2014 crash of his plane up in the Brooks Range in Alaska. The district court accurately instructed the jury on materiality. The debate there really began during the charge conference when the government was concerned that the standard law, which is that the statement has to impact the decision maker or the decision of the decision making body, didn't include the investigative phase of the NTSB proceedings. And therefore, the government requested that the instruction be modified slightly to include investigation, and it asked the court directly to use the language investigation in the charge. The court was reluctant to, and instead settled on a bit of a middle ground and changed decision of the decision-making body to decision or activities of the agency. We felt this is appropriate, and that the court did not abuse its discretion in doing so, because by instructing the jury this way, it clarified for the jury that it was to consider both the appellate phase of the proceeding before the NTSB, as well as the investigative phase of the NTSB proceeding. Mr. Kerr's concern that this overly broadened what the jury was looking at is really, I think, unfounded. The language that the defendant was charged with in both counts 1 and 2, these statements involving altitude, the propeller, whether his front seat passenger fell into the controls, were all very significant statements. And they went right to the core of the case, which is, as the court has already identified, if Kirst were at the proper altitude and he still crashed the mountain on a clear day, crashed into the mountain on a clear day, then something must have happened to intervene. And otherwise, if he's at a proper altitude, then he's all right. Then he's not reckless and so forth. So by making these statements, they were specifically designed to impact the investigation, cause the investigation to go a different route, or even affect the outcome of it, influence the investigators not to decide to recommend an enforcement action, or influence the ALJ not to uphold the appeal of the revocation of his license. And the instruction, too, further kind of hemmed in the jury. It did allow the jury to consider the activities of the agency, but the court specifically instructed that the activities and the decision of the agency in count one meant that they must be capable of influencing the NTSB investigation. And in count two, that those statements must be capable of influencing the NTSB appeal. And in the closing arguments, both parties explained to the jury that what the materiality element meant was that the defendant had to say something that would influence the NTSB in a material or important way. And so Mr. Kerr's concern is, well, perhaps the jury could have found that the statements impacted the jury in a non-material way, something like turning on a computer or sharpening a pencil or using a calculator. But it's just not the case the way the court worded the instruction, the way the parties explained the instruction, and the total nature of the trial, which was about these statements and how they were intended to affect the investigation to change the outcome. It's very obvious that Mr. Kirst intended to shift blame off of himself, and these statements were the way he tried to do it. These statements suggest that he was at a proper altitude approaching the pass, and that something out of his control occurred to force him down into the mountain. And this was a cascading sequence of explanations, including there was a downdraft that caused him to plummet originally 1,000 feet above the mountaintops all the way down to around 4,000 feet into the mountain, that the passenger slumped into his controls, that the propeller came off in flight, and so forth. So these are all significant things. And he was very dishonest and contradictory as he changed his explanation throughout. So the concern that Kirst has that somehow the jury would have mistakenly convicted him on something that was not important to the NTSB or something trivial is unfounded. And therefore, we ask the court to conclude that the instruction was proper. I mean, even if there was some error in how the court formulated the instruction, For all these same reasons, Mr. Kirst was not prejudiced because the jury was focused on the right things and the instruction led them to the right things. And the parties, both the defendant at trial and the prosecutor at trial, also consistent with that, pointed the parties to the most material things that would affect the NTSB investigators and ALJ in the most important, relevant, and immaterial ways. Mr. Voraybov did not address either of the other two issues before the appeal, so I'll move on and address those. The first issue raised in his brief was whether the NTSB investigation was a proceeding under 18 U.S.C. 1505, and we submit to the court that it most certainly was. However, as an initial matter, we believe that Mr. Kirst waived this issue by not properly raising it in a 12B3 motion prior to trial. The basis for making that motion...
We could still review it for plain error.
We respectfully disagree, Judge. We recommend or we believe that the court should not review it for plain error. The basis for the motion was reasonably available to Mr. Kirst before trial, and the motion could be determined without a trial on the merits. And it's a question of law, of course, and questions of law versus questions of fact lend themselves to Rule 12B3 motions and rulings before trial. And the question presented was whether there was a defect in count one, whether the NTSB investigation was a proceeding before under 1505. And there was no good cause for Kerr's failure to attack or make this argument before trial. The general allegations in the indictment informed him that the NTSB investigates accidents for probable cause, makes safety recommendations, but also acts as a court of appeals for pilots when the FAA revokes their licenses, and also stated that, in fact, in this case, the NTSB ALJ upheld the appeal of the FAA's revocation of Kerr's license. That motion did not, this argument that the indictment was defective did not need to go to a jury. There was no issue that the jury needed to resolve in order to assist the court with making that determination. The NTSB's authority to investigate, to hold adjudicatory hearings on the appellate side, to issue subpoenas to witnesses and for evidence, to conduct hearings, to administer oaths. All these things are spelled out in the enabling statutes that led to the formation of the NTSB to begin with. And they can be found at 49 U.S.C. 1113, 49 U.S.C. 1132, 49 U.S.C. 1133, and I could keep going. The point is...
Can I interrupt? This is not strictly relevant given the nature of the jury's verdict, because the jury checks off only as to count one, the mistaken statement about the altitude, and as to number two, about the altitude and about the rapid descent of about 1,500 feet. But nonetheless, I'm curious. There were two passengers in the back seat who I think could have testified whether it was true that Spencer had slumped against the controls. Why don't we get testimony to that effect?
Judge, I don't know the answer to that. I was not the trial attorney in the case. I would just suggest that the prosecutors did not feel that they needed the testimony of the two backseat passengers, or perhaps the two backseat passengers were not available or interested in testifying.
We had some testimony from one of them that they were low enough that she had to look up to see the top of the mountain. So one of them was available for at least one purpose.
That's my confusion. One of them was available, and I'm sorry, the front seat passenger did not testify, so I'm sorry for that confusion.
Well, the front seat passenger was Spencer.
Correct. So Spencer died about 1 month after the accident.
I understand that. And one of the backseat passengers did testify as to we had to look up to see the top of the mountains.
That's correct. She also testified that the plane was flying quite level, that there was no emergency on board, that the conversation was normal, as you said, that they were about one third of the way down from the top of the mountains, which would have put them roughly around 4,000 feet, which was too low to clear the pass, which was around 4,400 feet.
But I guess you just don't know the answer to the question as to why we don't get testimony from either of the two backseat passengers as to whether or not Spencer slumped against the controls.
Well, I understand your question a little bit better now. The backseat passenger who did testified that she did not observe Spencer slumping into the controls. And at the crash site, Spencer was still harnessed into his seat quite securely, which leads most everyone to believe that, in fact, he was not out of his harness. He was never out of his harness and therefore never slumped into the controls. And that's part of the problem that Kerst has here in this case, is he lacks such credibility because of the changing explanations that he gave, as well as the fact that so much of his statements, so much of his testimony in these proceedings is inconsistent with a lot of the other evidence in the case, both the GPS data, testimony from the backseat passenger, Ms. McCann, testimony from the eyewitnesses, and also testimony from the different folks who dealt with the propeller issue, in which the maintenance director for the plane, the NTSB, the FAA, all concluded that the propeller did not separate while the plane was in flight, and instead broke on impact when Kerst slammed the plane into the side of the mountain. But none of these issues are relevant to whether the indictment was defective or not, or whether the NTSB investigation is a proceeding under 1505, which is, in our view, a pure legal question. And the jury does not require...
I've got another question that's not strictly relevant to the outcome of this case, and you may not be in a position to answer it, in which case, of course, just say you can't answer it. Is it customary if you have a pilot who tells a falsehood about what happened that there's criminal prosecution of the pilot? It surprised me that actually there was a criminal prosecution here instead of just a loss of license and all kinds of other things.
I think what's interesting, Judge, in this case is that, as I understand it, if Kirst had not lied at all, the FAA would not have brought an enforcement action against him. And it seems to me that if the FAA had not brought this enforcement action against him, this case probably never would have gone criminal to begin with. So that's the best answer to you I can provide to that question. So because these facts did not need to be litigated before a jury, and because of the issue is really more of a legal question more than anything, we submit that Mr. Kirst waived the argument that the indictment was defective. Nevertheless, in our brief, we make the argument that the court was in fact correct, or that the case law supports the notion or that the investigation of the NTSB was a proceeding. And we run through these arguments citing the U.S. versus Technic Services Incorporated, U.S. versus Vixie, which is this court's authority, that if an agency has adjudicatory authority, then a proceeding investigation before that agency is a proceeding under 1505. We also cited the Garvey case out of the D.C. Circuit that outlines the split enforcement regime between the FAA and NTSB and concludes that the NTSB does have adjudicatory authority. And we can go on. I'm running out of time. But there was no error here for the court to conclude that the NTSB investigation was a proceeding. And there certainly was no plain error, because there's no clear authority that the NTSB investigation was not a proceeding under 1505. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Corso. Okay, Mr. Vorobyov, please make your rebuttal argument.
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. First of all, I have a couple of points to make on the jury instruction issue. I respectfully disagree with Mr. Corso about the standard of review. It's not abuse of discretion. Our problem with instruction is not a language difference. It's not how the district court formulated it. I think it's an actual legal error. So for that, the standard review is de novo. It's a legal question. Was or not the instruction accurately states the materiality standard? As far as was there argument of counsel here clarified the instruction, I think it did the opposite. As I said in my initial argument, the way the government has explain this instruction and the standard in closing argument actually emphasized sort of the broad nature of what materiality was under this instruction. So I don't think it helped, and I would direct the court to 12 AR 2193 or 12 AR 2147 as examples of how the government argued the case. So I think, if anything, the prosecutor's explanation exacerbated the problem with the instruction. I also wanted to briefly jump to the issue of whether or not there was a pending proceeding regarding count one, and specifically to the waiver argument. The reason I think Mr. Corso is mistaken on the waiver is because it matters very much in this case at what stage of the proceeding we are, you know, because NTSB, as he actually mentioned, they're in a split regime. They're an accident investigator, and they also have some adjudicatory responsibilities as an appeals board for an FAA enforcement action. So what the trial evidence done, and, you know, my argument certainly heavily relies on this, is it places the proper context for count one. At what point of the proceeding did the interview take place and the submission of the 61-point form took place? It was at the time when the NTSB was still acting only as an accident investigator, which where it has no enforcement authority, no regulatory authority, no sort of the type Mr. Corso mentioned. So that's a reason why there should not be a waiver. We addressed it in the briefing, but I wanted to make our position clear on this. There was no waiver because there were facts specifically regarding the posture of the case, which made the sufficiency of the evidence argument pertinent. Finally, I read the back passenger's testimony about the altitude differently than Mr. Corso. I actually think it helps the argument that Mr. Kirst certainly didn't knowingly lie about the altitude, because he was using her testimony as sort of a way to explain why he thought he was at a particular altitude. You know, she said that they were about two-thirds up the mountain. And he was kind of using that not as the only measure of altitude, but sort of as a way to quickly orient himself. So, you know, I'll submit to the court's reading of the record, but that's our reading of it. And was that the end of my time? Right now.
Thank you, counsel. Yes. I want to thank Mr. Vorobyev and Mr. Corso for their excellent arguments. This case will now be submitted, and the panel will take a 10-minute recess. The advocates are again commended, and you will hear from us in due course.
Thank you, Aaron.